access to medical care, so they go to the hospital too late and they get too sick, and there's complications. We do all these things to exploit and confuse and hurt people because they're not profitable. And the people that are remain who are profitable are insured until they become a problem, and then they're kicked off their insurance plans. They're coerced into leaving their insurance plans or can't afford to stay on their insurance plans and go on to public health care. We're already subsidizing private industry to an incredible degree by taking the sickest people and the most vulnerable people and insuring them with tax dollars. Why not use that money to insure all of us in the first place? Because the private market has done nothing good in the past 50 years.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I think it's a good book, and I hope people like it.
My guest has been Timothy Faust, writer and journalist with expertise in healthcare and a single-payer system. He's written for Splinter News, Jacobin, and Vice. We've been discussing his new book, Health Justice Now, Single Payer, and What Comes Next. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Women's health care has always been problematic in the U.S., but particularly over the last decade, with increasing attacks on women's ability to access reproductive health care, we have an inordinate amount of political attention being paid to what goes on in women's bodies below the waist. It's not just anti-abortionists and the evangelical right that fantasizes about women's healthcare returning to medieval times. Women's healthcare providers themselves are, to an extent, stuck in the past, according to a new book by my guest, Jennifer Block. She's an award-winning journalist who's written for The Washington Post, Newsweek, Reveal, and other publications. Her first book, Pushed, garnered critical acclaim. She now joins me to discuss her latest book, Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. Welcome to the program, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have to confess, reading the first part of your book made me very angry, just really, really angry, because you cite examples of women who go to the doctor when they have a problem, usually involving their reproductive organs, and no one listens to them, and they have to scream and shout and fight to get heard, and often they end up worse off, or needing even more medical attention. And every woman who's an adult woman can probably relate to some version of these stories, and it's pretty infuriating to think about how commonplace it is. Is this sort of unique to women? Men don't go through this, I guess?
You're not the first person to tell me that the book is making them angry. I wrote this book because I think if we're going to talk about how our power is undermined on the basis of gender, on the basis of race, on the basis of circumstance, and as feminists, we're talking about Me Too, and we're talking about Black Lives Matter, and we're talking about the pay gap. We also need to be talking about how our healthcare system is failing women specifically. One in three mothers give birth by major surgery today. One in three women lose their uterus to a hysterectomy by the age of 60, and yet our maternal death rate is rising. Women's life expectancy in the United States is not keeping up with peer countries. In fact, it's declining in 40% of counties. We're getting too many of the treatments and surgeries that we don't need and not enough of the ones that we do. And women are not the only ones to be undermined in the medical realm. I want to be clear about that. We have a very broken system that's affecting all of us. And we have, you know, on top of our lack of universal health care, we have poverty, racism, a lot of factors.
A broken healthcare system, of course.
A broken healthcare system. Yeah. But I think that that women are uniquely vulnerable. I mean, we cut into or remove the uterus more than any other organ, regardless of sex. Mm-hmm. And this treatment is affecting our health, our lives, our sex lives, and our ability to participate in society.
So let's talk about the fact that women do have complex reproductive organs because, of course, our bodies are capable of conceiving and growing and bearing other human beings. So it is a complex system that does require care. And of course, we do have more and more today women entering the business of providing these healthcare needs, right? There are a lot more women OBs than there were before. And one would imagine that that would have made a big difference, hasn't it?
That is a great irony. And I think that was the hope of the women's movement of the 70s and going forward, that if we just got more women into the profession, which at the time was very male dominated, that it would change things. But the fact is that childbirth, for instance, we intervene medically in the birth process more than ever. We have not been able to get that cesarean rate to budge. And today, 85% of OBGYN residents are female. So things haven't changed all that much. And, you know, I think we need to look at the history. Of course, we have a lot of skilled, well-meaning providers with good intentions who went into the profession to do good and take care of people. And that's really the motivation of most healthcare workers, especially today. It's not, you know, it's not a fun system to be a part of. But if you look at the history, it's only 100 years ago that what I call a hostile takeover happened of birth. Really, you know, birth was taken care of by midwives, and the medical profession, which was just trying to get itself together, really came in and took women into the hospitals, attracted women into the hospitals, women participated, but turned birth into something that women did upright, with support, with social support, with the expertise of midwives, and made it something that doctors really did to them. So put women flat on their backs, gave them drugs, extracted babies with forceps. We're not that far from what happened 100 years ago.
Hmm. We might imagine that those medical interventions save lives, that infant mortality, you know, would be much higher if we didn't pull babies out with forceps, etc. But that's not true?
Our outcomes don't show that at all. We have some of the worst outcomes in the industrialized world, both in terms of the outcomes for babies. We have very high rates of preterm birth, low birth weight. But our outcomes for mothers, our maternal death rate is actually rising today. And it's especially dangerous for Black women. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy or childbirth. So our outcomes don't show, yeah.
Let's talk about the story of the pill, the contraceptive, the oral contraceptive that women can take to have healthy sex lives without getting pregnant. The story of the pill you tell in your book, how does it illustrate the attitude towards women's healthcare? Because the pill itself has evolved dramatically.
So the pill, I find, is a really interesting conversation, and it's been a difficult conversation, I think, for feminists to have. We think of it as revolutionary, and it was. I want to be clear that When it came into use in the early 60s, it was a very different world. Abortion was very illegal and very dangerous. As a woman, you couldn't walk to the corner store and get condoms, and other forms of birth control were restricted to married heterosexual couples. So the pill was liberating and revolutionary back then. Today, we have a lot more information about the physiological effects of the pill. So we've always known that there's a risk of blood clot. We've known that. That's been a kind of accepted but rare risk. But we have a lot of research now that the pill, or any hormonal method, so when we talk about the pill, we're now talking about the patch, the ring, some IUDs, but it affects our metabolism, it affects how we build bone, it affects our mental health, it affects our sexuality, our sexual response, from how lubricated we are to our sex drive. And so I think it's been difficult for us to have this conversation. I saw a headline that said, is it feminist to question the pill? And so I think, of course, it's feminist to talk about all the information that we have. And I question whether the pill deserves the pedestal that we've put it on.
In general, medical technology has been seen as freeing for women, right? That, women can, we might imagine, to some extent, choose their means of contraception. Some women may choose, really extreme measure like a hysterectomy. Others may choose to stay on the pill for years. Others may choose an IUD. And if you do get pregnant and it's an unwanted pregnancy, if you happen to live in the right state, you might be able to access an abortion. And of course, it's not as good as it needs to be. But in general, medical technology and advancements have been seen as very empowering to women. Is there a problem with that story?
We have. I think we have this association with medical technology as empowering by definition. And of course, all the examples you gave are examples of how it certainly can give us control over our fertility, over our lives. But I trace back a line of thinking in feminism where some thinkers felt that our own physiology was oppressive, that menstruation is a curse and childbirth is barbaric and lactation is enslavement. And I think that ideology has hampered us a little bit, because then all medical technology becomes liberating and maybe we don't question it enough. For instance, women are being sold egg freezing right now as fertility insurance. And a lot of us have bought into that. I keep hearing from younger women who are enthusiastically freezing their eggs.
Because the idea is that if you can sort of put off having a baby, you could do more with your life, which is a very legitimate goal if you feel like that's what you want to do. But there's a problem with the egg freezing technology?
Well, it's being sold as fertility insurance. Like, it's a sure thing. Just freeze your biological clock, put off having kids, have them later. It's checked off on your to-do list. But first of all, I'm not sure we're fully understanding what egg freezing entails. You're basically donating eggs for your future self. So you take hormones the same way an egg donor would. You have to go in for the surgery to extract the eggs. And then that's invasive and costly. Then you're freezing them, you're storing them, paying for the storage, and hoping to use them down the road. 10 years later, 15 years later. And right now, the estimate of how likely a frozen egg is to become a viable pregnancy is something around 2 to 12%.
Wow. You point out in your book that tech giants Facebook and Apple announced that they, a few years ago, that they would pay for female employees to freeze their eggs. So corporate America likes this idea because you can get more productive work years out of women.
That's one theory. We've sold this idea. And, I'm seeing essays now from women who are hitting 44, 42, 44, going to thaw their eggs in the hopes of creating the family they've always wanted but thought they had been able to delay. And now they have to go through IVF. So that's the other thing that you're signing up for if you freeze your eggs. You're signing up for the most invasive, high-tech form of creating a pregnancy
in vitro fertilization, yes.
Right, which itself difficult. Is, you know, hormones, invasive procedures. And, you know, I'm seeing these essays from these women who are heartbroken and quite frankly angry because it didn't work. They went to thaw their eggs. Only half of them thawed properly. Only a couple of them out of the ones that were left actually were able to be fertilized, and then the embryos didn't take. And so I think that's going to be, you know, it's going to work for some women, just like IVF also doesn't have the greatest success rates. It works for some people, but it doesn't work for a lot of other people. And the other big question mark is what the risks are, both to the baby, but also to the women undergoing these procedures, taking all these hormones. We're not tracking that in any meaningful way. And there are suspicions that there's relationship to cancer. And so I think these are high risk choices that have costs, and I'm not sure we're fully talking about them.
Mm-hmm. You talk, a lot of women in general, over the course of their adult lives, get a skeptical treatment from their healthcare providers. Going back to what we started discussing and what you opened your book with, there is this broad and vague criteria of disorders that fall under pelvic pain, women who feel pain in their pelvic region, and it's difficult to diagnose, and oftentimes doctors, OBs, don't diagnose it correctly. What did you find in your research that you write about in your book about how women often end up having to diagnose themselves or just fight for the right diagnosis, do their own research? I mean, if you can't really rely on your healthcare provider to help you enough, it becomes really difficult because we're not trained doctors, all of us.
Yeah, so many women have stories of being dismissed. You know, their pain is repeatedly dismissed by multiple practitioners. One of the most staggering things I learned was how many women are affected by endometriosis. It's something like 1 in 10.
Wow.
And this is a disease that can be incredibly painful, debilitating. It's essentially causes these growths to form in the abdomen outside the uterus, and they're hormonally responsive. So when the cycle comes, they bleed. And so they cause like internal bleeding, really. And then they scar and they create scar tissue and the cycle repeats. And women with endometriosis, historically, it took, you know, 10 years to get a diagnosis. Now I think we're down to 7 years. So we're getting a little bit better. But the other thing I learned is that, as one doctor put it to me, it's an area where really no one is an expert, because it's been thought of as a GYN disease because the growths are hormonally responsive. And one treatment for it has, the most common one has been to put someone on the pill to stop the cycle. But as researchers dig more into this disease, what they're finding is that it's really systemic, and it probably belongs under the autoimmune umbrella, because it's causing it's affecting all sorts of other systems. So women with endometriosis have a higher risk for heart disease, a higher risk for other autoimmune diseases and other pain disorders, and possibly a higher risk for cancer.
So this is one of those areas of women's healthcare that is so, there's such a great need for more research, but there isn't enough, or even just, it seems as though there's a need for specialists in this area and there aren't enough.
Yes, yes. I mean, I just was talking, I did an interview with a New Zealand radio, and they were telling me that they have endometriosis clinics. And we don't, I've never heard of one in the U.S.
No.
The other thing is that women with endometriosis with all those growths need very specialized surgery. It takes great skill. It's, as it's described to me, it's almost like cancer surgery. It's navigating around this complex area of the body, making sure not to disturb any critical structures or nerves. And again, I'm told this is not a specialty of GYN. And it's also hasn't been a focus of general surgery. And so there's a very small number of surgeons around the country who do the proper excision surgery, it's called, and very few women can access it. Sometimes it's not covered by insurance. Sometimes they can't find the right person. And so it goes back to, we're getting the surgeries we don't need, but not the ones we do.
Jennifer, are women being subjected to treatments that are far too invasive or overkill, if you will, than what they need? Did you find in your research that, you know, women who may need one procedure end up being told to get something much more broad and invasive and irreversible?
Well, I think that the number of cesareans falls under the umbrella of overtreatment. The number of hysterectomies certainly does as well. I mean, we can look at other countries and they have about half the rate of hysterectomy. And I think, yes, what you're saying is accurate. A lot of the women who end up with hysterectomies really needed skilled surgery just to remove symptomatic fibroids, perhaps, or they needed a less invasive treatment, and instead they lost an organ. And they're often told, you know, if they're, you know, over a certain age, well, you've had your children, or you didn't, you know, you had your time.
As if that's all that uteruses are useful for, right? Like, it's just...
Exactly. And, you know, when I talk to physiologists and physical therapists, they talk about the uterus as this keystone of the pelvis, that it's at the crossroads of all these important ligaments and nerves and blood vessels that reach into our clitoris and labia, blood vessels that reach into our legs. And so I think we're very cavalier about this organ. You know, it has one purpose, and it's important to keep it in if you might have children, and it's not important if you've already had children.
Let's talk about abortion. It's such a critically important issue, also a very politically fraught issue. Older generation feminists remind us of the home abortions that they remember that were the impetus for legalizing abortion and leading to the decision, Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. We don't want to return to the coat hanger, you know, the days of coat hanger abortions. But given the lack of access to abortion in many parts of the country now, are you seeing a return to home abortions? And is the home abortion technology greatly improved today?
So yes, I did find a network of people who are providing abortions outside of the medical system, so underground again. But the important thing to know is that the abortion technology has changed. So we talk about abortion as surgical or non-surgical, but it really hasn't been surgery for 4 decades. Back before Roe v. Wade, abortions were performed by DNC. So physicians would dilate the cervix and insert sharp metal instruments to remove the contents. This happened.
And women everywhere have cringed listening to that last sentence.
Sorry. I think it's important, though, that we talk about what it actually means, as I know, as disturbing as it might sound. But this, you know, so this, the DNC happened under general anesthesia back then. It was an overnight stay in the hospital for those few women who could actually get legal abortions. And then right before Roe v. Wade, the technology started to change, and it really is due to plastics. We got the manual vacuum aspirator, and it's a fascinating history. I go into it in the book, but what we have today is it's not surgical. We insert a plastic cannula, it's called. It's got a soft tip. It goes into the cervix without needing too much dilation, and suction removes the contents, either manual suction or with the machine that probably most people are familiar with if they've had an abortion in the clinic. But there's a movement to really offer more manual vacuum aspiration, MVA, because it's much less traumatic, and it's not something that people need sedation for. So most people who go into the clinics today get what is called general often. It's really not general, but it's sedation. There was a great essay in New York Magazine about this, about a woman who was, you know, offered, you know, offered an MBA. You don't need to be sedated. You'll be able to walk, you know, walk away in 5 minutes. And she said it was the best. The title of the piece is "The Best Abortion Ever." So what's happening is that there's a network of people, doulas. Some of them are midwives. Some of them are just women, people who want to help, who are starting to offer this procedure, MVA, also menstrual extraction, which is a version of it that the feminists came up with in the 70s, and the misoprostol pill, which is half of the medication abortion that's offered, but it works most of the time.
I understand so some women are practicing on papayas to learn how to do abortions.
Yes, so I was able to find a training to learn how to do an MVA. Not something I planned to do, but I wanted to know what it entailed. And it was a day long training, and we practiced using a papaya, and that's how people are trained all around the world. And by the way, all around the world, people who are minimally trained, so clinic workers, not doctors necessarily. Most around the world are not doctors who are providing this, and they provide it very safely. So we're not talking about a return to the coat hanger days. We're not talking about, you know, dangerous back alley abortions anymore. We're talking about something quite different.
It sounds like a new edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves is in order with instructions on this sort of home abortion. And I should mention that book, of course, was seminal in kind of asserting the feminist perspective on women's healthcare many decades ago, but much has changed since then.
Yeah. And this was, you know, we have maybe this caricature version of the 70s health feminist as, you know, get your mirrors out, get your speculum, check, you know, look at your own cervix. And that was, you know, a big feature.
It was a revolutionary moment back then.
That's
women
right.
Women were taught to be ashamed of our bodies. Yeah.
And there was zero information. There were no books. Like Our Bodies, Ourselves. There were no shelves in the bookstore, and there was no internet to look up images. So it was very difficult to get information about the anatomy. So it was revolutionary. It was also stepping into the medical realm. But what the activists tell me today is that it was also really a way for women to access the cervix so they could perform menstrual extractions, which really served as early abortions. And this went on before Roe v. Wade.
And I should mention for our audience who's uncomfortable hearing all of these terms that we're talking frankly about, I think this is part of the issue too, right? Just being able to talk about women's reproductive health care and health and anatomy without casting it as shameful, and being able to talk about it matter-of-factly, because for far too long it's existed in the shadows. And I'm wondering, Jennifer, if you can also now sort of wrap up our conversation talking about what it is that you would like to see in the medical field. I mean, yes, it can be very empowering for women to do sort of home health care, but that's only something that you can do certain things with. When one needs intervention, when one really needs allopathic medicine to help, what are ways in which you would like to see the OBGYN field evolve? It sounds as though our systems are so complex and that the healthcare providers' training is not complex enough to match the reproductive health needs of women.
Yes. So one thing is that I think what we need to recognize is that OBGYNs are basically doing five different jobs right now. They're high-risk OBs, they're midwives, they're endocrinologists, they're surgeons. And in other countries with better systems, they really pick one and focus on one. They're also expected to be primary care doctors now, so they can be reimbursed as primary care doctors since the 90s. So I think that's one way that we would get the skilled surgeons we need, we would get the physiologic labor support we need. We need high-risk OBs, but we really need more midwives. Midwives are the experts in the normal birth process. Their training is to support it. That's really not the training of the OBGYN.
Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, shedding light on some of these issues. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Jennifer Block, award-winning journalist who has written for the Washington Post, Newsweek, Reveal, and other publications. Her first book, Pushed, garnered critical acclaim. We've been discussing her newest book, Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
It is 6 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is the Youth Collective discussing yelling. But first,
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. The Social Justice Action Center provides community space, access to a commercial kitchen, and now new open hours. The launch party will provide information about new programs, opportunities to volunteer, and more. Again, that's the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.